Thanks very much, Elizabeth, and thanks for coming today. So what I, as Elizabeth said, what I'm going to do today is talk about some of the key risks around the outlook for the Australian economy. I'll draw on the material published last week in the August Statement on Monetary Policy. On the global side, I'm going to discuss some of the implications of the trade and technology disputes between the US and China. And then on the domestic side, the key risk for some time has been the outlook for consumption, and I will highlight some of the main uncertainties that are likely to affect that outlook. Beyond the near-term risk for the economy, climate poses a material risk for it and financial markets over a longer horizon, and I'll talk a bit about that. And then finally, given the audience, and actually given a fair chunk of the rest of the program, I will remind you of something which is an actuality, not a risk, that you need to be prepared for, namely the cessation of LIBOR, the key interest rate benchmark in financial markets. Let me start with the trade dispute between... Hang on, there we go. So that's what we're going to talk about. Let me start with the trade dispute between China and the US. So that's been with us in its current form for almost 2 years now. The direct effects of the tariffs that have been posed to date on global growth hasn't actually been all that large, though the impact on particular businesses has been significant. Rather, the larger impact has been the uncertainty generated by the dispute. That uncertainty has taken two forms. There's uncertainty about the size and the incidence of the tariffs, so where, you know, who's actually going to get hit with them, and uncertainty about how and even if the technology dispute will be resolved. So let me start with the tariff side. So the prospect of a 25% tariff is a first-order consideration, not surprisingly, in determining whether to invest in a new factory or a new machinery and where to locate that investment. But it's plausible that the effect of the technology dispute will be larger than that of the tariffs. The technology dispute raises the possibility that any business involved in the technology, global technology production chain might have to choose between East and West rather than whether they're just going to sell into a global market. The uncertainty as to how the dispute will play out on both the trade and technology fronts means businesses are waiting to see how the uncertainty resolves rather than invest. It is too risky to commit to a multi-year project or buy a large piece of plant if the economics of that decision can get completely undermined by a policy decision or by a tweet. The effect of that decision to wait rather than invest is clear in surveys of manufacturing businesses right around the world, which have fallen to low levels over the course of the past 12 months as the dispute has intensified. So that's what I'm showing here. So this is the PMIs, purchase manufacturing indices for the world in yellow, so that's aggregating everyone up in the world, the US in light blue, and East Asia in red. So the effect, and all of them, as you can see, have come down quite significantly over the past 12 months, pretty much a direct impact of the trade dispute. And as you can see, it's a particularly apparent in East Asia and most obviously South Korea, but as well as countries like Germany, which overnight, in the last quarter, has recorded negative growth for the first time in a while. Both of those countries are heavily integrated in the global supply chain and obviously produce a large amount of investment goods. And Korea obviously is very heavily integrated in the global technology chain. That said, the impact is not universally negative. Some economies have actually recorded increases in investment. And the most obvious case here is Vietnam, which is pretty much close to full capacity as businesses relocate operations there to try to avoid the direct effect of the tariffs. However, they've been so successful in that they're now very much on the radar of the US and may themselves be in line for the next round of tariffs. Investment in manufacturing sectors reflecting this around the world is weak and is dragging on global growth. But at the same time, the domestic side of a number of economies, which is insulated from the trade dispute, has been resilient to date. And so reflecting this, employment growth has actually been strong, and unemployment rates are at multi-decade lows in the US, Japan, Germany, and even the UK. So notwithstanding how weak everything has been on the external side, particularly on the manufacturing side, by and large, the domestic side of most economies has kept on going at a pretty decent pace, and a lot of people are getting jobs. So despite these increased uncertainties around the outlook, businesses have been continuing to employ workers at a solid pace. In part, this is because it is generally easier and less costly for businesses to adjust the size of their workforce than it is to adjust their capital stock. In turn, both are much less expensive and easier to adjust than the decision to build a whole new factory. But this short-term adjustment via employment can only go on for so long. In the end, the decision to build or not build that new factory needs to be taken. The longer businesses are holding off, the weaker demand will be, which will further confirm the decision to wait, and that runs the risk of a self-fulfilling downturn. If, on the other hand, domestic demand remains resilient, there could be enough demand that businesses decide an investment will be profitable regardless of the trade uncertainty. So we'll just have to see how that plays out. Another material outcome of the current dispute, which would have a large and long-lasting impact, is the threat it poses to the system of rules-based trade that has prevailed for many years. So despite some flaws, that system has provided a high degree of certainty around the operating environment. The China-US dispute casts serious doubt on that. And we can also see that manifest in the US-Europe trade issues, as well as those between South Korea and Japan. So trade is being used currently as the bargaining tool of choice, including for issues that don't have much to do with trade. So how is the trade dispute affecting the Australian economy? So Australia is not very involved in the global supply chain, particularly for technology. We consume a lot of the end product, but we don't provide much of the inputs along the way. We export resources, not microchips. So when we ignore the advice of Carly Fiorina when she was here in 2000 and said, why are you guys doing so much digging out of the ground? You should be in the microchip industry. Luckily, we didn't pay any attention to her. So while the Australian economy is often regarded as a proxy for China, the primary exposure of the Australian economy is to the Chinese domestic economy, not the Chinese external economy. The external sector has been the part of the Chinese economy most affected by the trade dispute. As the external sector in China has come under pressure from the trade dispute and the Chinese economy has slowed, policymakers there have responded with stimulus to the domestic economy. So far, they've been mostly relying on fiscal policy rather than monetary policy. Our assessment is that the degree of overall fiscal stimulus in China is probably about on par with that they delivered in 2015, but still noticeably less than the very large stimulus implemented in 2009 in the aftermath of the GFC. The stimulus has been directed to the parts of the Chinese economy that are steel intensive, most notably infrastructure. And that obviously has boosted demand for coal and iron ore. In turn, the price of iron ore in particular rose by much more than expected, receiving a further significant boost from reduced supply in Brazil in the aftermath of the tailings dam collapse there, as well as weather-related supply disruptions here in Australia. So as a result, the terms of trade in Australia, the price of our exports over the price of our imports, are significantly higher, are at their highest level since 2013, and more than 10% higher than we, and pretty much everyone else, thought would be the case. And that's what we're showing here. So where we are now is basically that the top of that red line. That's our current forecast. We expect them to decline a reasonable amount from here, and I'll show you in a second, the iron ore price has already come off a fair bit, but that's about 10% higher than we thought 12 months ago. So how does that rise in the terms of trade feed through the economy? It is a significant boost to national income, particularly given it has occurred alongside a depreciation of the Australian dollar. However, it is often quite difficult to pin down the channels through which a rise in the terms of trade propagates through the economy. What is clear is that we are not going to get a repeat of the resources boom that occurred when iron ore prices were last at these levels. There is some increased investment in train in the iron ore sector, the large iron ore producers, but that's to maintain the current levels of production, not to materially increase them. So we've seen the effect of the increased demand in China reflected in the price, not in higher export volumes. About three quarters of these profits from the higher iron ore prices accrue to foreign shareholders, but the rest does actually flow through to domestic households through their direct and indirect share ownership. Public sector revenues also get a boost, mainly through higher tax receipts and mining royalties, but it's unclear what the governments will do with this unexpected revenue. So in the end, we're somewhat uncertain as to how this, you know, it is a large boost to national income, but we'll just have to see how it propagates through the economy. But the domestic stimulus in China to offset the trade dispute has contributed to a short-term boost to the Australian economy and significantly mitigated the impact of the trade disputes on us. How long this lasts will depend on the effectiveness and longevity of Chinese domestic stimulus. So as I said, the iron ore price, so this gives you an idea about where it's gone. So this time last year, it was about, I think, high 60s, got up to about 110 or so, and it's dropped back a lot in the last week. But you can see, so that I haven't shown our forecast, I've shown consensus forecasts, but it's about the same. It's a considerably higher, well, ridiculously higher increase, actually. So just to give you some idea, the average cost of production for the large Australian miners is about $15 a tonne. So for a while, they were sitting there with a margin of around about $100 a tonne, or 10 times. Not a bad business if you can have it, I suppose. But as you can see, it's significantly higher than it was, although it's obviously come down. Australia also has significant exports to China in both tourism and education. To date, these have been broadly unaffected by the slowdown in the Chinese economy, but a further significant slowing there and in household incomes in China would clearly pose a risk. So in the end, to date, the Australian economy has been largely shielded from the effects of the trade disputes. But Australia has been a major beneficiary from the rules-based global trading system over many decades, and the current threats to that are clearly a major risk for the Australian outlook, over a longer horizon. Let me now turn to the domestic economy and talk a bit about consumption, which has been the primary risk for a while. So the risks to consumption are always going to be important because consumption is around 3/5 of the economy. Over the past few years, it's been challenging to assess both the current pace and outlook for the consumption. What I'm showing here is where consumption was in the June quarter 2018 national accounts, so that's the orange line, and then the purple line is what the ABS is recording as consumption growth now, and then the line at the end is our current forecast for consumption. So in the first half of 2018, consumption had been recorded as growing at a solid pace at around 3%, so that's a bit above actually, as you can see in the orange line. But the September quarter 2018 national accounts recorded both a notably slower pace of consumption in that quarter, but also a downward revision to the recent history, so that growth was measured to be around 0.5 percentage point slower than had been previously recorded. So, not surprisingly, that changed our assessment of the consumption outlook. The momentum was clearly not as strong as we'd previously thought, which was further confirmed with slower growth in consumption in the December and March quarters. So what has been weighing on consumption? A primary cause has been the slow pace of growth in household income, disposable income, that is, income after tax. Household income growth in total has been low for a number of years now, and that's despite strong employment growth and clearly reflects slow wages growth. As households have come to expect that this slow wages growth will persist, they have constrained their spending plans. But on top of that, and despite the low income growth, household tax payments have grown at a very fast pace, 10% over 2018. So what I'm showing you here is gross income, which grew at about between 3 and 4% in 2018. Tax paid grew by 10%. This seems to have reflected increased compliance and lower tax deductions, as well as a bit of bracket creep. But as a result, income left after tax was considerably less than we, and I suspect households, had expected. And this contributed to a further slowdown in consumption spending. Overlaid on the slow growth in household income has been the effect of the decline in housing prices. Some part of that comes through a wealth effect, that is, as housing prices fall, wealth declines, which reduces spending. Some part of that effect comes through the lower housing turnover that has come along with the decline in housing prices. So turnover in the housing market, the number of places bought and sold, is around about its lowest level in more than 20 years. When people move house, they spend more on things like household furniture. They're not moving house, so they're not doing that. So the decline in housing prices has also been accompanied by a particularly large reduction in spending on cars, some of which we think has probably got to do with tradies having a bit less income. They do a lot of the car spending. But looking forward, there are a number of factors moving in different directions that affect the outlook for consumption. Income growth is picking up, although only by a little. We do not expect much of an increase in wages growth, although employment growth is expected to be reasonable, though slower than recent history. But household disposable income growth, so that's income after tax, is likely to be higher because of the direct effect of the tax offset payments to low and middle income households, and also because we don't expect that tax paid is going to significantly outpace income growth again this year. So the low and middle income households are getting their tax refunds around about now. We actually send them out, so we know that. It's uncertain how much of that they will spend or save or use to pay down their mortgage. But based on past experience, we are assuming they will spend around half of it. We'll see how this plays out through our liaison and in the data in the coming months. Households are also benefiting in aggregate from the effect of lower interest rates. While the income of households with deposits is lower because of rates being lower, the household sector as a whole has around about twice as much debt as they do deposits. So the cash flow boost from lower mortgage payments outweighs that from lower deposit rates. Again, there's uncertainty about how much of that cash flow boost will be spent or saved, including the form of paying down your mortgage faster. But if households do use the additional cash flow to pay down their mortgages, it does bring closer the date that they will be comfortable with their balance sheets and return to more normal spending habits. A final factor affecting the consumption outlook is the dynamic in housing markets. There is evidence that the decline in housing prices has reached its end. If this is the case, the drag from declining wealth and turnover will dissipate. Housing market conditions may even start to support consumption growth again in the period ahead. So in conclusion, there are some near-term downside risks to the consumption outlook, including from a softer labour market. Further out, the risks of the outlook are a bit more evenly balanced. And looking at the domestic outlook more broadly, we are expecting that GDP growth outcomes to strengthen after a run of disappointing numbers. And that's assessment is supported by a number of developments, including lower interest rates, the recent tax cuts, a depreciation of the Australian dollar, a brighter outlook for investment in the resources sector, some stabilisation of the housing market, and the ongoing high level of investment in infrastructure. Obviously, going the other way is that very large global risk I mentioned up front. Determining how the combined effect of these developments is going to play out is difficult, but the overall risks appear to be a bit more balanced. Having talked about two major near-term risks for the economic outlook, I'd also like you to remind you to take appropriate account of one risk that plays out over a longer horizon, namely climate risk. I talked about this in detail earlier in the year. So given your roles as managers of risk, it is important that you have a useful framework to assess this risk for your business. Climate is a challenging risk to assess, but an increasingly necessary one. Businesses need to take account of both the physical risks and the transition risks. So physical risk is about the direct impact of climate on your business and the assets that it holds. You need to ask the question, what will be the effect of climate change on the price of an asset my company owns, particularly if it's a long-lived asset, such as, for example, a mortgage? Transition risk is about the potential effects to business of the country and the economy adjusts to the changes in the climate. This includes the adjustment to policy responses required to meet the Paris objectives. As risk managers, you can bring your skills at calculating the expected future value of financial assets across a number of potential scenarios. And in that sense, climate risk is not that different from other risks. Though the challenge of translating uncertain future paths for the climate into paths for the economy and the price of financial assets is harder than some of the other risks that you generally deal with. Even though it's hard, it is a challenge that needs to be confronted. And I would emphasise the importance of disclosure, echoing the comments by Jeff Summerhayes and John Price, as well as the guidance that ASIC released on that earlier this week. You should all be aware of the recommendations of the recent report of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, or TCFD, that's chaired by Michael Bloomberg. It's important not just to have disclosure for disclosure's sake, but to have consistent and informative disclosure. Investors need to be able to take account of that information in making their decisions, be able to compare that across companies and across financial assets. Risk management under uncertainty is always challenging, but the challenge can be reduced with better and consistent information, both in terms of the data inputs and the consistency of the scenarios considered. Let me just finish quickly on an issue I spent a bit too much of my life on in the last few years. which is quite different from the risks I've discussed so far, and that's the fact that the end of LIBOR is not a risk, it's a certainty that the finance industry needs to be ready for. So it's just over 2 years now since Andrew Bailey announced that the FCA will no longer use its powers to sustain LIBOR beyond 2021. So this is beyond 2021, just over 2 years from now. Financial regulators around the world expect institutions using LIBOR to be ready to transition to more robust benchmarks. With strong support from the RBA and APRA, ASIC recently wrote to the CEOs of major Australian financial institutions to seek assurance that they are taking appropriate action. The transition from LIBOR to alternative risk-free rates is accelerating internationally. Use of RFRs in derivatives markets is increasing, and they are being adopted in some cash products. There's also been good progress on developing more robust fallback provisions in contracts referencing LIBOR. As I hope you're all aware, ISDA has completed consultations on the fallback methodology for almost all of the LIBOR currencies and also BBSW. And they found strong support for using as the fallback the compounded RFR with an adjustment for the historical spread between the risk-free rate and the credit benchmark. Once ISDA has finalised the fallback provisions, regulators expect users of benchmarks to adopt them. In Australia, we've taken a slightly different path. BBSW has been strengthened over recent years and coexists alongside the cash rate, which is the risk-free rate for the Australian dollar. This has been possible since both BBSW and the cash rate are supported by underlying markets with enough transactions to calculate robust benchmarks, but that's not true elsewhere in the world, and most obviously with LIBOR. We have been encouraging users of Australian dollar benchmarks to choose the benchmark that is most appropriate for their circumstances. Sometimes it makes sense to use a credit-based benchmark like BBSW. Often it makes more sense to use a risk-free benchmark, such as when governments raise funding, and there's been progress on this in recent months with SAFA issuing the first FRN referencing the cash rate. Nevertheless, the lesson from LIBOR is that no benchmark should be taken for granted. So while BBSW remains robust, it is prudent to have robust fallbacks in your contracts in case it were ever to cease. And that's why we've been working with ISDA to strengthen the contractual fallbacks for BBSW too. So from our point of view, the RBA's point of view, we'll be managing our own risks in this area by requiring new securities referencing BBSW to have robust fallback provisions in order to be eligible in our market operations. So to conclude, I've highlighted two near-term risks to the economic outlook, one global, one domestic. I've also raised the longer-term risk of climate. None of these risks are easy to assess, but nor can they be ignored. And finally, I've just highlighted the issue of benchmark reform that is not a risk but an actuality which absolutely needs attention right now. So thanks. Let me finish there and happy to take questions either old school or technology way. So, Elizabeth, over to you.
Thank you, Guy. What do you expect from recession in the US? I guess, and that's coming from an anonymous person.
I'm not sure that I expect a recession in the US, so I don't know what to expect from it. someone else, the clear recession sign. I suppose let me just talk a bit about, the yield curve going inverted, which I assume is what the last question is about, I'm not sure how much of a signal that is at the moment. There's, if I look at the yield curve right around the world, term premia are basically, you can reasonable case that term premia are negative. If I stuck a normal term premium on the end of the US yield curve, it would have a nice, not particularly large, but nevertheless an upward slope. Same's true here, actually. So I'm just not sure how useful that signal is, if that's what the signal you're referring to. At the moment, the US economy is actually growing above trend. So they've got a fair way to slow from here, but nevertheless, that is a risk, certainly, and the trade disputes, I think, are the key risk to that. So I suppose that's how I'd answer that question. It's obviously a risk out there. I'm not sure I'd be relying on the yield curve as the best signal of that risk, given the yield curve has not obviously got the same sort of structure that it's had historically.
Did you see the question there about the cash rates?
We always look at labour market and inflation outcomes, because labour market has a material influence on inflation outcomes. So I'm not sure, you know, I don't know if I can, you know, I can't say it's like 40%, 60% or something like that, but it's, we obviously take account of the full suite of information in the Australian economy in determining our assessment for policy, including how developments in the labour market feed through to wages and inflation outcomes. I don't think that's changed materially any time recently. I think it's basically the same sort of analytical approach that we've taken over a number of years, or certainly over the last 25, 30 years.
I see there's a question about courses adapting to the risk management needs
I think that's one for you, Elizabeth, not for me.
Well,
but I'm happy to take a few questions from the floor if not all of you are masters of the technology. So,
Andrew Vellner, SuperG. The RBA came out after the election, cut 50 points. Market says it's about to do another 50.
Mm.
Could you point us to the statements just before the election saying we're about to rush out 100 points of cuts? Or no. If not, was there a significant change in the RBA's approach or view on the economy?
So what we got was an accumulation of evidence that, one, the labour market wasn't as strong as had been previously indicated. From the unemployment side, employment growth actually continued at a reasonable pace. The other piece of information we got over that time was that wage outcomes were lower than we'd previously expected. That came out, both those pieces of information emerged after the election. So over the course of the first half of this year, we had highlighted that the risks around the outlook were changing. We got evidence which confirmed that that was the case, and not also the rate of unemployment that the economy could sustain without jeopardising the inflation outlook was probably lower than we previously thought. So having taken account of that accumulation of evidence that that caused us to deliver the rate reductions that we did in June and July.
Any other questions from the floor? We can have time for one more.
Justin Faber, Macquarie. In terms of the outlook, one of the strongest bits you've got is business investment, and I've read and reread the statement a few times, and as you'd expect, you actually talk about non-mining business investment growing more slowly, mining investment picking up a bit over the next year and then a bit more. But you've got 4% growth this year, nearly 6% next year, nearly 6% the year after for business investment.
Yep.
The global risks to business investment seem to be down. Can you just elaborate a bit on how those forecasts come about?
Thanks. Some part of that is related to the infrastructure. So the infrastructure is both on the public and the private side, but a decent chunk of it is coming through on the private side, and the outlook there still looks pretty solid. In fact, in this city and in Melbourne, infrastructure investment's about at capacity. That's what we get told anyway. So I think some decent chunk of it is coming through from there, and so it's in the private sector, but it's on piggybacking, well, very much closely associated with the infrastructure investment going on, which has got a large public sector element to it as well. You're going to talk about benchmarks later on, maybe I'll just talk quickly about those two benchmark questions. On the issue about RMBS, what product's suitable for a credit or a risk-free benchmark, I think that's a good question. So if you think about what state governments do, I've actually always found it odd that they historically have issued as a spread to BBSW, given they are much more closely aligned with the Commonwealth government's issue, so more with a risk-free rate. And so that's why I think it's really good that SAFA has led the way in issuing a security based on a risk-free benchmark. When it comes to something like MBS, though, that is much more of a credit-related product. Or if a bank's issuing a piece of debt, that's clearly a credit-related product. And so a credit spread, a credit benchmark, I think, makes reasonable sense. So I think it's really a question of thinking what's fit for purpose. And I think historically, no one's actually particularly thought about what's fit for purpose. It's just LIBOR is out there, or has been out there for a number of decades. That's what you use, so you just write it into your contract without thinking about whether it makes sense or not. And if you go back prior to 2007, the spread between credit rates and risk-free rates was about zero anyway, so it didn't make much difference. Then it blew out a lot, which also highlighted that maybe you should be thinking about which one is actually more appropriate. So I think we've now got to the point that people are aware that these two benchmarks do move in significantly different directions, or can move, and actually maybe you should be thinking about what's actually fit for purpose, as well as what's likely to be more robust in the medium term, which comes to the other question. So at the moment, we see a reasonable amount of transactions in BBSW, as the ASX provides us with the data that underpins the benchmarks that they're calculating each day. It's not, you know, they do fallback, utilise the fallbacks on some reasonable frequency, depending on the tenor. But by and large, the market in Australia, in terms of short-term bank paper, is enough. Clearly enough to underpin those benchmarks for the foreseeable future. But to hark back on something I mentioned in the speech, I don't think you should completely assume that is always going to be the case. So at the very least, you should make sure that you know and are comfortable with the fallbacks in your contracts, and, well, one, that you actually have them, and secondly, that you're comfortable with them. So, you know, at the moment, we don't see anything on the horizon that necessarily threatens the longevity of BBSW, but it's very, coming from a risk point of view, it is very much a risk that you should all be aware of and making sure that you have the appropriate mitigants in place so that you're not suddenly exposed to that risk should it suddenly materialise. As I said, we don't expect that to be the case with BBSW, but for LIBOR, we do expect that to be the case, and so you absolutely need to have those fallbacks in place and be transitioning away from LIBOR where possible between now and 2021.
Thank you so much, Guy. Look, I'm sure everyone would like to join me in thanking Guy for an excellent and thought-provoking presentation.